Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Our guest this week is John Traphagen, a professor and the Mitsubishi Fellow in the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Texas, Austin. Professor Traphagen has a wide range of research interests, including Japanese religion and society, the relationship between culture, religion, and science, medical anthropology, and astrobiology. He is the author of several books, including Science, Culture, and the Search for Life on Other Worlds, Extraterrestrial Intelligence and the Human Imagination, SETI at the Intersection of Science, Religion, and Culture, Imagine Families, Lived Families, Culture and Kinship in Contemporary Japan, and Rethinking Autonomy, a Critique of Principalism in Biomedical Ethics, to name just a few of his works. I recently came across two articles that he published on the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, or SETI as it is abbreviated, which were absolutely fascinating. These works were entitled Cargo Cults and the Ethics of Active SETI in the Journal of Space Policy and Do No Harm, Cultural Imperialism and the Ethics of Active SETI in the Journal of the British Interplanetary Society. This may seem a little bit out of the scope here on Research on Religion, but I can assure you that these were fascinating reads that really get us to think about what happens when two different cultures meet one another. Sometimes asking questions that are a little bit out of the box can reveal important insights about our own lives that are worth thinking about. And I should add that I'm including one of these articles in my syllabus on political culture coming up at the University of Washington in fall. So if you're around, take that class. We will link to Professor Traphagen's work on our website, plus a few of the other websites dealing with this topic that I'm sure that will come across in our discussion today. Really interesting stuff. Please check it out. John, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here.
You are a professor of religious studies at UT Austin, hook 'em horns, and you write about the ethics of searching for alien intelligent life outside of our solar system. Now, that's quite the mix. So how did this all come about? What is the intellectual trajectory that got you to where you are today?
Well, it has a lot to do, I suspect, with Star Trek, like so many people who are interested in space exploration. I watched it in its first run as a kid in the 1960s, and then actually didn't ever imagine I would be pursuing research that was in any way related to that. I went to college and got a bachelor's degree in political science, and I was interested predominantly in political philosophy, and then I did that at the University of Massachusetts at Lowell, and then I went on to Yale, and I did a master's degree in social ethics, and I actually took a few years off and worked in the business world, and then when I went back to graduate school at the University of Pittsburgh, I focused on social anthropology with an emphasis on Japan, and never at that time had any thought that I would be doing research related to SETI or anything like that. My work, though, has dealt with the intersection of culture and science and religion pretty much throughout my career at one level or another. I'm trained basically as a medical anthropologist, so my early work dealt with how Japanese people conceptualize senile dementia. And that, of course, is very tied in with the scientific community and scientific definitions of disease. And then over time, my some interesting things came out that I read, and I contacted a couple people related to SETI, including a guy named Doug Vakoch, who was at the SETI Institute at the time, and got interested in thinking about these things, and eventually wound up, they invited me out for a talk at the SETI Institute, and that was about 10 years ago, and I've been writing on and off and doing work on and off related to this ever since.
Now, that was after you were tenured, right?
That is a fact, yes. Yeah. It's easier to do these things once you've been tenured.
Yeah, that's what I'm finding, too. You can explore things that you've never thought that you would explore and seem a little bit weird and outside of the box. But really, when you come to think about it, actually makes us think about a lot of our assumptions about things like religion and our present contemporary culture as well. And that's what we're going to be exploring here today. Do any of your colleagues kind of give you gruff or kind of snicker in the hall that you're doing stuff on SETI when you're in a religious studies department?
Well, not anymore. I think they've gotten used to it. But early on, I encountered pretty regularly what I would call the giggle factor. When I would tell someone that I was doing this, they go, oh, that's kind of interesting. And then I kind of felt like I was getting a little pat on the head, and yes, you go do your weird things. But I think over time, as people have, you know, I've given talks and people have seen what I'm doing, they've come to realize that my research really isn't about E.T. It's about the people looking for E.T. It's about trying to understand how the search itself generates an understanding of humanity and how that gets expressed in the scientific community. And so, you know, you can't imagine E.T. really without thinking about humans. It's pretty hard to do that. And so I find it, as an anthropologist, a very interesting question to raise when thinking about how we conceptualize ourselves. It's really a question of identity and human identity.
And it's an excellent way of doing it, too, because you strip away a lot of other noise that we would have, say, if we're doing an anthropological study down in South America somewhere. You say, well, there's, you know, television and all these other things coming in. No, let's take a look at a culture that's completely foreign, has no contact with us, and that strips away a lot of the noise and really gets us to think about ourselves, which is what makes your work just absolutely fascinating. Let's go ahead and start out by talking about what SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, is, as well as these two other terms that you use, active SETI and METI. What are those things?
Well, quite simply, SETI is the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, or another way to put it, really, it's not that astronomers and others are looking for intelligence. They're looking for signs of intelligence. So something that would indicate that there's another technological society somewhere out there in our galaxy. Basically, what that means is most likely a radio transmission or something like that. Active SETI is... So SETI itself is typically passive. It's listening. Active SETI is actually sending messages. It's taking the other perspective of, well, rather than just sitting back and listening, let's send out something in hopes that somebody will hear us and maybe respond. And active SETI and METI are really the same thing. METI is just another way to say it. It means messaging to extraterrestrial intelligence. So really there are two forms. There's passive and active SETI, and one is on the listening side and the other is on the sending side.
So we have a lot of these telescopes up in the Arizona desert and all around the planet where we're listening to different radio signals and things like that. We've seen those in pictures and the like. But what about this active stuff? Are there governments doing this? Are there private institutions doing this? How are they sending messages out? And what are they sending? Are they sending the, you know, Led Zeppelin albums out there to show everybody how cool we are or what?
Well, a lot of things have actually been sent, and actually that's really one of the real problems. There is no government oversight of any of this. You can, you know, if you have a powerful enough telescope and, you know, a radio telescope, you can send something that will go pretty far. There have been very serious attempts to send out messages that have been carefully constructed. So a good example is the Arecibo message that was sent from the Arecibo Radio Telescope in Puerto Rico by Frank Drake, who's one of the founding people involved in SETI. And he constructed a message in binary that includes information related to the structure of DNA. It shows awareness of certain kinds of scientific ideas and the nature of the cosmos. It has a stick figure that looks like a human figure. It actually shows something that would indicate our solar system and which planet we're on. And this was sent out to a globular cluster about 25,000 light years from Earth. And that's an example of active sedity. It's sending out a message that, you know, one would hope somebody will intercept, a hope probably a really long time from now, if it's even strong enough for anyone to pick up. That particular message doesn't represent much of an attempt at active SETI because it isn't likely to ever be received by anybody. It's more of a kind of a technological demonstration that shows that we could do something and also raises questions about how we might construct a message. You know, this is one of the most difficult issues, is you want to make a message. Well, we're dealing with an intelligent life form that evolved on a planet different from ours. They must be different from us in some way, maybe very significant ways. So the question is, could anyone actually understand anything that we sent, even if they recognize that maybe it came from an intelligent or marginally intelligent species here on Earth? And so that's one of the efforts, is to try to figure out how would we construct something. So that, again, is back to being very much about us as much as it is about what might be at the other end. There are a lot of other things that have gone on. There are, of course, you have the Pioneer spacecraft and the Voyager spacecraft, and all four of those have, they have messages on them. The two Pioneer spacecraft have a plaque that shows the figure of a male and a female. It shows, it actually has a map that shows where our solar system is, and it has a graphic representation of our solar system with an arrow pointing to the third planet. It's really an interesting idea. It also raises a lot of the problems with communication. One of the big problems is that, for us, an arrow seems like a really obvious thing that's a pointer. But if you happen to evolve on a planet that never developed the idea of the bow and arrow, it might be a completely meaningless symbol. So it seems like it makes sense to us, but how do you convey that to somebody who grew up in a different environment, completely different environment? The Voyager spacecraft both carry the so-called golden record that has a lot of images. It has music. It has, hello in a whole bunch of different languages. These are not likely to ever be encountered by anybody in any reasonable amount of time. I think it would take Voyager 40,000 years to get to the next nearest star, and it will only pass within about a light year of that star, one of the Voyagers, I don't remember which one. But the point is, these are attempts at figuring out how to communicate much more than really sending much of a message. And then more recently, there have been people there's a guy named Bill Kitchen, who's an engineer who has made a lot of money, and he wants to send... Basically, I think he wants to send the genome of the entire human species into space and a whole bunch of other information about us as what he calls a backup. And he's got the money to do it, and he says he's going to do it. So he's quite adamant about this idea. In fact, despite the fact that there are significant ethical questions about whether or not we should be doing this.
Yeah, that's the interesting question we want to come up with. And it should be pointed out that not all SETI scientists are active SETI advocates. So give us an example of somebody who might be interested in SETI, but saying, whoa, 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 let's pull the reins back on this active stuff.
Well, there are quite a few, actually. The most notable, I think, is Jill Tarter, who was the director of the Center for SETI research at the SETI Institute for a long time, has really been a major player in the field. She argues that we should basically leave it to technologically more advanced civilizations to try to contact us. She thinks we are in an evolutionary adolescent phase. I have never really understood that. I don't know how you would know what an adolescent phase is in a civilization, since we're the only civilization, and we're not one civilization, we're many civilizations. So that piece of it has never made much sense to me. But her argument is that we should listen and leave it to a more advanced society to contact us. And I think for her that comes out of a sense that they will be not only technologically superior, but morally and intellectually superior, and therefore will have a better sense of how to deal with contact than we're likely to. There are others, you know, people like Stephen Hawking is very concerned about the potentiality of really nasty alien beings coming here if we're sending out messages saying, hi, everybody, we're here, come check us out. Well, if you think about intelligent life on our planet, a lot of it is associated with predatory behavior. And in fact, it may be that intelligence arises in part in relation to predatory behavior. So it might be that a very, very advanced society out there somewhere is predatory, which would probably not be too good for us. Science fiction writer David Brin has noted that pretty much throughout human history, when technologically advanced societies come in contact with less advanced societies, it's always bad for the less advanced society, even if it it's the context, you know, there's good intentions on the part of the more advanced society, it usually causes a lot of problems for the other ones. So in general, I think this has actually been a very heated debate in the overall SETI community. Probably the most heated debate is whether or not we should be sending anything out. Another fairly common argument is who speaks for Earth. So if Frank Drake sent a message, you know, from the Arecibo dish, well, who gave him the right to speak on behalf of our entire planet? That's a very reasonable question. And since we have no governmental oversight or anything like that to deal with this, it's pretty much whoever wants to talk can talk.
One of the things that you bring up with respect to the ethics of active SETI is the set of underlying assumptions that many of these active SETI advocates do have. You touched upon some of them, but let's examine these a little bit more explicitly. What are these assumptions, and how do they come up with these assumptions?
Well, I actually think the assumptions are a little bit broader than that. I think SETI as a whole tends to work from a set of assumptions that, from my opinion, draw from a kind of 19th century approach to cultural evolution. If you think back to anthropologists like E.B. Tyler and Lewis Henry Morgan in the 19th century, they were seeing the evolution of society along a kind of Darwinian framework of and really constructing it in a line that was very intertwined with the notion of progress. Of course, that was a powerful concept in the 19th century and still is. But so the idea was basically that Euro-American style civilizations were not just technologically more advanced, they were better than other kinds of societies, like tribal societies, and that they had moved along a kind of moral path that made them morally more advanced. And one of the examples they would typically use for this is the move from animistic, polytheistic types of religious systems to monotheism. And the idea was that monotheism was a more advanced form of religion. Now, again, the data don't support this. If you look at ethnographic data, you know, all you have to do is go to Japan, and it's all messed up, because Japan is a, I think we would argue, a relatively advanced society from a technological perspective. Japan has very little crime. It's, you know, the homicide rates and violent crime rates are very low in Japan compared to the United States, or Europe, for that matter, for the most part. And Shinto, which is one of the main religions in Japan, is animistic and has multiple gods, lots of gods. So clearly, that isn't what happens with humans. But that kind of mindset that there's this correlation between technological development and cultural development, I think has really shaped the way SETI scientists have thought about what ET might be like. And as a result, you find SETI leaders like Jill Tarter and Frank Drake and others arguing that because ET has lived a lot longer than we have, much longer civilization than ours, because they have figured out how to have a stable civilization, because they're technologically advanced, they must be morally and socially advanced in some way. So this really doesn't compute from an anthropological perspective. This is not what we see in our own planet. And so I think this has actually created some real problems. The other set of assumptions that are really problematic are, most of the time when SETI scientists think about both our world and ET's world, they think in terms of a monolith. They see human civilization and alien civilization. But all we have to do is look around, and we can see very quickly that we don't have a civilization on Earth. We have lots of civilizations. We have lots of different societies with different social structures, with different ways of politically organizing themselves. We have dramatic differences in socioeconomic status, dramatic differences in religious ideas. So we don't really have a civilization on Earth. Well, why would we think ET has a civilization? And I think some of that, the reason people think that in the SETI community is basically because they watch too much Star Trek. They are working from an idea that there's this linear evolutionary process leading to a unified world that becomes a civilization in which basically everyone thinks more or less the same way, kind of the Federation kind of model. I don't really see any evidence to think that's going to happen. Even if our planet becomes unified, we're still going to have lots and lots of differences in political ideas, lots and lots of differences in religious ideas. I don't think we'll have a homogeneous planet. But when SETI scientists think about ET as well as our own planet, they tend to think in terms of a very homogeneous place in which there isn't a lot of political conflict internally.
You can see that in Star Trek. My wife and I are making our way through the old television series once again, and whenever the Enterprise encounters another civilization, they tend to be pretty monolithic. There's one
right.
person that always speaks from. There's a few episodes that have some conflict in it, but yeah, you can. It makes for easy television. You only got an hour to make the story, so therefore you're going to simplify it pretty much. But if you carry this out into actual active SETI, I can see how this could be a problem. And you play this out in the article that you wrote for the Journal of the British Interplanetary Society, that you're wondering whether or not this is a good idea, thinking about the ethics here. And you present this hypothetical thought experiment called Neron's Surprise. And I thought this was fantastic. The topic itself lends itself to some hypothetical thinking. Run us through this scenario and explain why it is important for helping us to understand the ethics of SETI.
Well, as I started thinking more and more about the problem with active SETI, almost all of the arguments against are related to what will happen to us. I suppose in very typically self-centered human ways, we're all worried about our own survival. We don't tend to give too much thought to what might happen at the other end. And I think part of this goes back to this, what I've referred to as a Star Trek imaginary, in which they're superior, they're advanced, and, you know, we're adolescents. And you know, you see, Kirk is always having these moments where, you know, he meets the super advanced civilization and they decide there's hope for humanity, even though we're still adolescents, that kind of thing. Well, that may not be what ET's world is like. And so I started wanting to think about what could happen if we send a message out and ET, you know, intercepts that. How would they think about the knowledge that there is another civilization of some sort out there, that there are perhaps intelligent beings? And so I just started kind of working this through, and what I did was I pulled together some examples from my own work related to Japan and kind of borrowed from a few other places to sort of create my own little world out there. Do you want me to, you know, kind of go into what's going on with that?
Yeah, please do, because I the example was just absolutely fantastic. And I love these hypotheticals. This is why it made my way into the syllabus I have in the fall, because this is just a guaranteed discussion point of, like, what happens when somebody with this culture meets somebody with that culture? Is it monolithic? And if it's not, what happens?
All right. So what I did was I gave my alien scientist, who's sitting in his radio telescope office somewhere on the planet I called Nerd. Neron is a scientist, and she's they're a very technologically advanced place. They've spread out to other planets in their solar system. They're on other moons. They live in a pretty unified political structure. They had war in the past, but they've gotten to the point where they don't fight wars. They've given up on religion completely. They've decided that that's silly superstition, so they don't do religion anymore. But they're not, of course, homogeneous. There are different people with different ideas, and they sometimes have conflict. And like any society, they have an ideology. They've developed a way that they think the world is, and they've ordered themselves along the lines of that. So what happens is Neron is sitting in her office, and the signal comes through, and she looks at it, and it looks pretty weird. And the more she thinks about it, the more she realizes this may, in fact, not be natural. So she gets confirmation from other scientists who agree that this doesn't look natural, and she's really excited. So she calls in her colleague, who's a linguist, and his name's Flurg, and Flurg gets all of his graduate students together, and they work tirelessly on this for weeks and weeks, and they determine that this is from an alien civilization. In fact, there's quite a bit of information in it. There is information about mathematics. There's information about music. And there's a lot of interesting stuff there. In fact, what has happened is that the message has come from Earth, and we've used what I call the Seth Shostak. He's an astronomer who's very one of the real leaders in SETI, who has argued that if we do active SETI, what we should do is we should send the entire content of the Google servers, because then what you wind up with is a kind of Rosetta Stone. It gives enough data that aliens could actually figure out perhaps what we're about, because they'd have a lot of things that they could triangulate from. So that's what we've done. Humans have sent out the Google servers, and Neron has intercepted it, and on Nerd, they're figuring all this out. So then I started thinking about what kind of world does Neron live in? What is her world like? And what I decided was one way to imagine her world as being stable, balanced. There are castes. There's an upper caste that consists of educated elites, artistic people, philosophical people. Oddly enough, politicians are in there too. I don't know why, but they are. There's a middle class that has agriculturalists, and the middle class is actually, or caste, is seen quite positively because they provide food for the upper caste and for the entire society. And then there's a lower caste that consists of merchants, and they're regarded quite negatively because they engage in work for profit. In other words, they're seen as being self-centered. They're focused on their own gain as opposed to the social gain. However, they're fortunate because since they work for profit, they have a lot of money, and they can buy some of the things that are associated with higher status related to the elites and to the middle class. The key to Nerd is that they have an ideology that balance and reciprocity are the key to a stable society. So balance and reciprocity among the different castes are what keep everything stable. It prevents warfare from happening. It prevents political conflict from getting too out of control. And they also have a highly ritualistic society where they emphasize decorum as a way of maintaining that balance and maintaining reciprocal relationships. Now, that idea comes right out of Japan. That's very much the way Japanese society has worked. And during the Edo period, from around 1600 to the middle 19th century, they had a caste system. It existed before that, but it was a very strong caste system that operated along this kind of sense of balance. So this is not alien to humans to have a society like this. So balance is the fundamental prerequisite for the evolution of advanced intelligence and social order from the perspective of the Nerdians. They see this as having to happen in order for an intelligent society to emerge and for a large civilization to emerge. So Neron and her colleagues are all looking at this stuff, and there's some really weird stuff about the data. One of the things that the data that they're getting from Earth shows that we do things like polluting our world. We have wars. We have political conflict. But we're also technologically fairly advanced, advanced enough to send out messages. In fact, the more that they dig in, the more they see our world does not seem to be organized around balance, but it's organized around imbalance. That we are not characterized by the thing that they see as being fundamental to making a civilization work. So what does that do to them? That's really the question that comes to mind for me, is that if ET intercepts something from us, and the way our world works seems to critique and contradict their own ideology about the natural order of things, it could then lead to a destabilization of their society. And for me, that means we shouldn't be sending messages. But that's the essence of the thought experiment.
Yeah, this gets into Star Trek stuff too, like the prime directive that mm-hmm. always comes up that says, don't interfere with anything, you just observe. But the minute you observe something, it changes a balance. I'm thinking the most recent Star Trek reboot, I think this was the second film where the Enterprise comes up out of the ocean, say, you're not supposed to do that, and you had this... it was actually supposed to be, quote-unquote, a primitive culture. All of a sudden sees this thing come up, and then the next thing you see is them drawing these images of the Starship Enterprise in the sand as if it just recreated a new bit of knowledge or piece of cultural information that probably is going to shift the balance between who's in charge, who's not in charge, and who wants to be in charge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's exactly the kind of problem. And it's interesting that in Star Trek, Kirk basically sees the prime directive as something to ignore. And when you ignore it, it causes problems for the society. One of the difficulties with, particularly in the original series that crops up, is they seem to have an idea that the Federation is superior. I'm thinking of, there's one episode on a planet called Gideon or something like that that's horribly overpopulated. And they clearly, the Enterprise, or Kirk at least, sees their overpopulation and their unwillingness to use birth control and other things as being sort of inferior. That's the feeling that you get. So they may have a prime directive, but at least in the original series, they don't use it that well. Now, the prime directive idea has been an argument that has been made by some SETI scientists as to why we haven't received anything. Maybe more intelligent, more capable beings are all over the place, but they know interfering with our world would mess things up so that they don't actually communicate with us.
They might just be out there looking at us and not doing anything. So.
Right.
Now, the example that you give, this hypothetical Neron surprise, is really interesting. It is a hypothetical, and we don't have any idea of what extraterrestrial intelligence would look like, let alone how it's organized. But your paper on cargo cults and the ethics of active SETI actually draws upon some earthly experiences when it comes to two different cultures with two different levels of technology coming into contact with one another. You've already talked a little bit about Japan, but let's go ahead and discuss this paper a little bit. What is a cargo cult? If you could give us some examples, and then what are the dynamics that come out of these cargo cults?
Cargo cults are typically, they arose in Melanesia, and they seem to have arisen in relation to contact with Europeans and Americans. And indigenous peoples would see these people from outside coming in with very different technologies, with what seemed to be a great deal of material wealth. And they were interested in how to acquire that. How do they gain control over similar sorts of abilities? And they have done interesting things. For example, you can see if you go online and look at cargo cult, you'll see things like pictures of an airplane that has been constructed or an airstrip And it's made of straw. The airplane is made of straw. And so they will capture the form of the technology, but they don't really understand the content of the technology, so they don't know how to make an airplane. This often, I think, was done, one of the arguments, the way that this was done, was to, not necessarily to the foreigners, but to get the ancestors to bring cargo to increase their own wealth. But there's a lot more going on with this than just, you know, what looks on the surface like, okay, these are people that don't have an advanced technology. They're trying to mimic the technology of outsiders to gain wealth. There may be some of that, but it's often has turned out that it is a much more intricate combination of a response to an outside group that is dominating the people that are creating these cargo cults. So it becomes very much more like a millennial movement, like we see among Native Americans in the United States in response to an imperialistic American government, you know, moving across the West. And a really good example of this was a cargo cult that emerged in the 1960s in Papua New Guinea and New Hanover that is known as the Johnson cult. And what happened was a group of people there raised about $1,000 that they wanted to use to pay to bring Lyndon Baines Johnson to become their leader, which seems kind of ridiculous. Obviously, he wouldn't be doing that. And the local authorities, the colonial authorities, basically made it clear that it was ridiculous. They said, well, he's busy. He's dealing with the Vietnam War, and he's dealing with other things. He's not going to come. That's fine. They may have been interested at some level in bringing LBJ, but much more was going on. Ultimately, they did not participate in normal elections and other kinds of things that were being run by the colonial government. And I think generally what's been interpreted is that this was much more of a critique of the status quo and of the colonial environment than it was really a desire to get a foreign leader to come and take over. They were trying to get the point across in an environment where they didn't feel that they could be heard, that they were not happy with the environment that they were in. So what this really turns out to be is a very sophisticated response to political inequality and to an imperial and colonial environment. So the cargo cult is, at least in this case, and I think in probably a lot of these cases, is one way to express a kind of dissatisfaction with the status quo in an environment where people feel disempowered to make that expression in an overt way. So that's in essence what a cargo cult is about.
Yeah, that was a great article, and we will link to it on our website. That it gets us thinking, you know, well, you know, maybe this was good to upset some of this political inequality, but on the other hand, we don't know. Right, and that's what you bring to light with the Neron's surprise hypothetical example, is that we really don't know. Maybe this might make things better, according to our definition of better, but on the other hand, you have absolutely no idea, and it's a wide open endeavor. So,
yes, and I think that the difficulty is, without any knowledge of what the other end might be like, simple awareness of the existence of another civilization that might be very different from their own could be highly disruptive to their civilization. That's one of the things that really concerns me in relation to active SETI. You know, it's possible that if we send out messages, ET will find them and come here and eat our brains. I don't know. But for me, the bigger worry, really, is that without any knowledge of what the receiver would be like, there's no way for us to to even make an educated guess how contact with us and awareness of us could be beneficial, disruptive, neutral. We just don't know what it would do to their civilization. So I think that what we should do is not send because of that.
Now, your two articles examine the ethics of how we might affect relations with alien civilizations, even if we don't make contact, but just indicate, as you say, that you're not alone out there. We're out here, too. But have you done any speculation about how this might affect social relations here on Earth if we get a signal that we're not alone? How do you think finding somebody out there might affect our social and religious landscape?
Well, I think, first off, I don't think you can actually answer the question. And this gets back to this issue of diversity. I don't think there'll be a reaction. There'll be lots and lots of different reactions. I think one of the problems in the SETI community is that you have largely a group of intellectual elites who see the world in a particular way, and they see the possibility of ET contacting us in a particular way. When I think about it, I imagine, for example, what is it, something like, I don't know, maybe 2 billion people on our planet live on something along the lines of $2 or $3 a day. I don't think they're going to care. I think they're too concerned with simply finding a way to survive on a day-to-day basis for the presence of ET out there on some other planet that's really far away to matter much to them. So I think one of the things that is typically argued as a justification for SETI research is that this will be the biggest moment in human history when we finally answer the question of whether or not we're alone. But I suspect that a pretty large percentage of our 7 billion don't really care if we're alone. So it might have very long-term major consequences, but I think in the short run, I think it's unlikely that it will have much of an impact at all on our planet, except among those intellectual elites and maybe political elites that are suddenly trying to deal with, okay, well, what does this mean? It'll impact them, but I don't think it'll impact most humans because it's just not that immediate for them. And in many respects, I think we have some examples of this that help us think through. Oddly enough, although most people don't really think of it this way, we already have had an experience of having thought we encountered ET. Percival Lowell in the late 19th century wrote strongly that there were canals on Mars that had been created by a great Martian civilization. This was run through the public media, it was in magazines, people talked about it, there was no panic or anything like that, there was a lot of discussion. And then it kind of petered out because it became fairly clear that it was unlikely that there was anything on Mars approaching a civilization. It became clear that the so-called canals were just lines that largely were coming out of Lowell's imagination in many ways. I think another example of a kind of potentially, you know, world-changing moment people talk about is the landing on the moon. There was a period where I remember this as a kid, where the world felt very unified around landing on the moon. That lasted, what, 15 or 20 minutes? It just didn't change anything. And again, maybe in the long run, it will have had the effect of making us more aware that we live on a single planet. Maybe that it has had that effect. But we're still polluting it, and we also have people out there claiming that our planet's flat, and that they're growing in numbers. So I don't think there are very many of them, but, you know, they're out there. The flat earthers are talked about. So I don't think that we can predict what change might happen, but my own opinion is that I don't really think there will be that profound a change if we actually intercept something at some point. I think it'll be an interesting moment. People will think, wow, that's cool, and then they'll go back to their daily lives.
Interesting thoughts on that. Any thoughts that we might create our own cargo cults, especially amongst these SETI folks? They might just say, hey, you know, we're justified now for, you know, taking over the Earth and leading us forward here, so we're going to, you know, take this bit of information we have. Any thoughts on that?
Well, it's interesting that you ask. I actually think SETI is kind of a cargo cult. When you look at the SETI Institute's website, there's a very interesting thing that if you look at their FAQ page, and there are all sorts of really fascinating things. And I don't mean this in any way to disparage SETI. I think it's a useful and important thing, and there's a lot of very interesting stuff going on. But where it gets interesting is when you read the justification for doing SETI research. And one of the things it says on the SETI Institute's website is that perhaps ET will be a more advanced, altruistic kind of, you know, society, whatever, that will bring us knowledge about how to solve our problems, like poverty and pollution and war and all these other things. And it actually goes on to even speculate that maybe they will bring us into an interstellar collective of advanced civilizations that, you know, and it kind of gives the feeling that, you know, these are peaceful people and they figured out how to survive. That sounds like cargo to me. It sounds like the very similar thing to what's going on in the cargo cults is that by making contact and by doing things that generate contact, perhaps we will solve an unsatisfactory status quo. That communication with ET will provide us with the tools that we need to correct our problems here. And in essence, what cargo becomes in this case is not a president, but knowledge. Knowledge that would allow us to solve our problems. It may be that that's the case, but we have no evidence that there's anything out there. So at this point in time, it's kind of wishful thinking. And I think it's wishful thinking that has some similarities to the idea of the cargo cult. So I think in that sense, it's sort of, kind of, is already happening. I also think that if we make contact, there will probably be groups of people who will form one form or another of millennial movement in response to the unknown about what contact means for us. And you know, there'll be people who are afraid of the potentiality and people who are hoping they come here to save us. I think there'll be a whole variety of millennial movements that might occur. They may not be really widespread. Again, I think most people will just go back to their business, but I suspect that kind of thing would happen.
One final question here as we come to the end of our time. You've been at the academic game for roughly the same amount of time that I have. What have you learned throughout the process that has changed your mind about the world and or that may have really surprised you? And if you could travel back in time to visit 18-year-old John Traphagen, what would you tell him, if anything?
What I would tell 18-year-old me is whatever you do when you're 56, don't write a letter to yourself telling you what to do, because that spoils the adventure. Yeah. So I think the beauty of the academic life is that you're forever on an adventure of exploration, and you're learning new things about the world. It's a wonderful way to be able to orient your life around discovery. And discovery in lots of different ways. It's self-discovery, it's discovery of other things. I'm actually enjoying at the moment watching my son, who's about to start his PhD in a field totally different from mine. And he's at the beginning of that process and very excited about all the things that he's learning. And I think one of the best things about the academic world is, you know, you mentioned tenure earlier. Tenure provides you the opportunity to pursue crazy ideas and try out different things that often can really change the way you see the world. I think for me, as an anthropologist, the thing that has probably been the most profound change is that I have come to think of humans not as humans, but as a collection of extraordinarily complex and diverse ideas that really make communication difficult. And I think when one thinks about trying to communicate with ET, it's going to be much more difficult than just communication here. But I also think that's one of the extraordinary things. There are a lot of different ways to organize life and a lot of ways to organize society. I think the other thing, probably more than anything, that my particular academic journey has raised is that I've really come to conclude that, you know, back to my general interests in ethics and right and wrong, is that morality is really a human construction. It's something that humans make. And I think, you know, many people want to believe that there is something out there, whether they're, you know, divine command or natural law. I don't think that's the case. I think it's a right and wrong is a product of human invention. And I actually think that's a really good thing, because it's liberating for us. It means that we have the capacity to think about and control how we put our world together. We're not at the mercy of deities, of, you know, higher powers, of natural law, whatever it is. We can organize our world in a way that we want to, and that if we choose to take responsibility for that, I think that's the route to creating a really good world, much more than E.T. coming here and saving us. If we take responsibility for our own ideas about right and wrong, about how we want to make our world, I think we can do some pretty amazing things. And that's been kind of the maybe the big thing that's come to my mind over the years of my being an academic.
Very fascinating thoughts, and your work really does prompt us to think about a lot of different questions in a lot of different ways. We'll link to your works and some of these other websites that we mentioned on our website, so we encourage people to visit it. My guest today has been John Traphagen. John, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Okay, thank you very much for having me. I enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.